Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Juliet Frumholt, filling in for Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we recap a series of reporting on Dayton's water resources with WYSO's economics reporter, Lewis Wallace. Wayne Baker talks about growth in Clark County's tourism industry, and Bill Felker brings us the latest edition of Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, one of the arguments in favor of the Affordable Care Act was that it would reduce dependency on emergency rooms by covering more people with basic preventative care. Now millions of people are newly covered by Obamacare, so are emergency rooms seeing a slowdown? Not so much. WYSO's Lewis Wallace takes a look at where ER visits are going and some new options that are available. On the street in downtown Dayton, Rebecca Jacobson says before Obamacare,
I didn't have health care. I didn't have anything.
She's racked up thousands in medical bills. Now she's on Medicaid. Ohio's one of the 27 states that expanded that program with federal funds. She was in the emergency room just last month, admittedly not for the most serious problem.
I thought I had lice, and I didn't.
The symptoms?
My head was itching and they just said I have dandruff.
An ER visit for dandruff. This is just the kind of situation some people will point to and say that's burdening the whole system. Jacobson says she would have gone to a regular doctor to see if she had lice, but it was the middle of the night and the ER trip didn't cost her anything. Up the road at Miami Valley Hospital, Dr. Darren Pangalangan, an emergency doctor with the Premier Health Network, says he thinks people should be able to use an ER when they need to, or think they need to.
You cannot go to your family doctor at midnight. They're not open at midnight.
The big Obamacare question, though, is this. Will people actually depend on ERs less for basic care once they're insured, driving costs down for everyone? Or will more people, like Rebecca Jacobson, go to the ER because, well, now they can?
The cost of going to the emergency department might be a major deterrent for the uninsured.
Catherine Baker is a Harvard health economist who worked on a study of new Medicaid recipients in Oregon. She found that people who got on Medicaid then went to the ER more.
Once they have access to insurance, they can go to the emergency department without being concerned about being presented with an enormous bill at the end.
Howard Mell with the American College of Emergency Physicians says many of his members are seeing more traffic, though ER visits were already on the rise.
Most emergency departments have actually seen an increase in the amount of people coming through the door. It's not a huge increase, but it's certainly noticeable.
But another study in Massachusetts found expanding to near universal health coverage led to less people using emergency rooms in cases where it wasn't really an emergency. So overall, the jury is still out. Some 13 million people are just now settling into having health insurance, either through Medicaid or the ACA exchange. It's not clear yet how all those people might use the ER differently. But the county health system in Cleveland, MetroHealth, has already been reducing ER use. Dr. James Mysak says as they expanded Medicaid to 30,000 new patients,
we didn't just give them a Medicaid card and say, here you go. We said, now let's get you hooked up with a primary care physician. Let's get you into care.
He says they offer drop-in clinics and what's called managed care, where your primary care doctor or nurse helps you navigate the system and avoid unnecessary costs or trips to the ER for avoidable problems. And health networks like Premier and Dayton are trying to offer some alternatives to ERs. Catherine Lorenz is a doctor at what's called an after-hours clinic in Troy. They're open from 5 to 9 p.m. and on weekends.
You can walk in up to the last minute and we would see you.
The clinic helps folks who can't get a quick appointment with a family doctor for something acute like back pain, poison ivy, or lice. It's a less costly option than an ER for sure. But Lorenz also says there are things she can't do for patients here.
A lot of times I'm arm wrestling them to go to the ER and telling them, yes, you must pay your copay and get in there because you have a life-threatening illness.
Right. It's not like most people are in a huge rush to go to an emergency room. Take Roberta Gillum, who I meet on her way to the bus in Dayton. She says she recently got Medicaid and she's been taking advantage of it by getting preventive care, not by going to the ER.
I've had my pap smear, I had my mammograms, had my dentures, my x-rays, and getting ready to get me a partial. It's been a blessing.
It's the safety net she's grateful for.
When anybody can get insurance, you know they're happy to have insurance, especially the ones that can't afford insurance.
And emergency care is really just one small piece of the puzzle. More people getting coverage is likely to mean more use of all kinds of health services. The basic economic principle is when something becomes cheaper for people, they use more of it. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Democrats in the Ohio legislature are introducing a bill that they say would require employer-provided health care insurance plans that cover prescription drugs to cover contraceptives under the same terms without charging a copay. State Representative Kathleen Clyde says the bill would make sure Ohio companies would not be able to use religious freedom, as Hobby Lobby did in a recent Supreme Court case, as a way to prevent their employees from getting IUDs and birth control pills.
We have to act to protect women from interference by their employers in their personal, private health decisions. We have to act because, plain and simple, your health care is not your boss's business.
Clyde says this bill would not go against the Supreme Court's ruling because it affects private companies under limited parameters. The bill would also mandate that companies could not discriminate against employees because of their reproductive health care decisions. This is WYSO Weekend. In his 2 years as director of the OSU Marching Band, Jonathan Waters was praised for using technology to develop complex routines that went viral on the web. Now John Waters is out of a job. OSU fired him after an investigation found what officials call serious cultural issues. WOSU's Mandy Trimble reports Waters intends to clear his name.
Waters' firing comes after a two-month investigation prompted by complaints made by a parent of a band member. The investigation uncovered sexually explicit activities which appear to have gone on for years. In an online video statement, Ohio State University President Michael Drake called the findings of the investigation profoundly disappointing.
Very serious cultural issues and an environment conducive to sexual harassment within the band, creating a hostile environment for students.
Ohio State compliance investigators interviewed 9 former or current band members, Waters, and other band leaders. The report details a tradition which involved band members marching into the horseshoe late at night wearing only underwear, a newsletter with explicit disparaging information about band members. Rookie band members were given sexually charged nicknames. It also describes drunken, sexually lewd behavior during away games and on buses. Investigators concluded band director John Waters knew or should have known about the activities and failed to eliminate the sexual harassment. The report also states Waters would yell and swear at band members at times. Again, OSU President Drake.
Even one instance of harassment or hazing or assault is one too many. And though we are not alone among campuses across America facing these serious issues, this is our home and our responsibility.
Contacted by phone, Waters declined to comment, but referred us to his attorney, David Axelrod. Axelrod would not be recorded for this story. Axelrod says Waters was shocked by the termination. He said OSU last week gave Waters a choice, quit or adopt a zero-tolerance policy and agree to a cultural assessment of the band. Axelrod said his client wholeheartedly agreed to cooperate and keep his job. But Axelrod said university officials called Waters back this week and reneged on their offer, giving Waters another choice, resign or be fired. Axelrod said the university has given no reason for the change in offer. Waters has a long history with the OSU Marching Band. Before he became band director in fall 2012, he was an assistant director. As a student, he marched with the band. Axelrod called Waters' firing inappropriate and unfair, noting Waters inherited the cultural issues. In the report, Waters said he took steps to fix the culture. He said he eliminated the underwear march in the shoe and banned the derogatory newsletters. But when investigators asked Waters why he tolerated sexually explicit nicknames, he responded with, "Good point." Assistant band director Christopher Hoke testified the marching band's culture is moving in the right direction and said no one has worked harder to address the culture than Waters. And a former band member we talked to on condition of anonymity said Waters did make efforts to change the culture and suspended a band member for inappropriate behavior. But OSU President Drake said the university will move forward with a new band director.
We must do better. Every single student on our campus must be able to learn, to grow, and to experience Ohio State in a safe and positive environment.
The university says it will offer counseling to band members as they need it, and OSU officials say former Ohio Attorney General Betty Montgomery will conduct an assessment of the band's culture and offer counsel on Title IX compliance. Axelrod contends Waters has been wrongfully terminated. He said Waters plans to clear his name, though Axelrod could not say if that means a lawsuit in the future. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Mandy Trimble in Columbus.
Clark County is seeing its tourism industry grow, according to a recently released economic report. WYSO's Wayne Baker spoke with Chris Schutte of the Greater Springfield Convention and Visitors Bureau about the study and the troubled Upper Valley Mall.
Now, I understand that the recent study has shown that the impact on tourism has exceeded $360 million. Can you talk a little bit about how that study is done and what that means for Clark County?
Sure. The Greater Springfield CVB, through the State Tourism Office, actually commissions a study by Tourism Economics, which is part of Oxford Economics. They actually do county drill downs every 2 years. They do a statewide study each year for Tourism Ohio, and then every 2 years we get the county drill down. And this year, our impact report shows a total tourism impact of around $368 million, and the good news for us is that was up $42 million since the last county drill down, which was for calendar year 2011.
What do you attribute the success to? It seems like there might be multiple factors that would go into that sort of jump.
You know, when you really look at it, tourism as a business is a very diverse composite of economic activities. You have transportation, recreation, entertainment, retail, lodging, food and beverage. So all those things play a part. And I think, you know, for Springfield in particular, our tourism offerings are very diverse. We're not completely connected to one attraction or one venue, you know, i.e. we don't have a water park or a professional sports team or something like that that drives most of our tourism. So in that way, we are very diverse. Now, I can tell you that over the past couple of years, we've seen upticks in things like business travel for, let's say, training for some of our larger headquarter companies like Navistar, Kona Cranes, Code Blue, Speedway. They've generated a lot of business. And then I think we've also seen an uptick in convention business here through our marketing of the National Road Convention District. And then really the third component is just leisure travel. And I think, you know, we've done a lot of work over the past 3 or 4 years trying to position and brand Springfield as a real leisure destination, as a getaway destination. And I think now we're finally starting to see that pay some dividends.
Now, the mall's problems and some of the things that go along when you read that it could be in trouble, how are you guys able to overcome some things like that?
Well, and you know, that's interesting. And I think that, you know, perhaps the mall's imminent closing is a little bit overstated. I think really the mall has a fairly healthy mix of merchants out there right now. And I think especially with the Boonshoff Museum of Discovery having recently been added to the mall, I think you're starting to see some increased traffic out there. So I think really what we're talking about are more kind of financial wranglings than anything else. Our Convention and Visitors Bureau operates under the chamber. We look at a lot of things like downtown redevelopment and how do we pull more retail, how do we pull more entertainment venues downtown? I think the mall has fortunately been a little bit of a victim of that, where, you know, a lot of strip centers, a lot of urban malls, they have started to lose some of their tenants, and they've started to lose some business to what are either sort of recreated downtowns, you know, like if you look at Easton or the Green as an example, or to actual downtowns. And our downtown, I think, is kind of on the edge of a renaissance right now. Long term, hopefully both of those things can coexist. I think there will always be tenants for a mall, and I think as our downtown starts to redevelop, I think you're going to see some good things start to take shape downtown.
And Springfield itself, the rebranding that you guys have been looking at for a few years now seems to have taken off, and you know, also you've got the barnstorming carnival, things like that happening in Clark County. This has got to be a very positive news in terms of getting a new brand out there. And what do you see in the future in terms of challenges and in terms of things you'd like to continue to build on?
We've tried to kind of change the perception a little bit and let people know that, you know, Springfield is perhaps a little bit more urbane and a little bit more sophisticated than you may think. Unbeknownst to some people, we're a true full-fledged city. We're not a one-stoplight town. And that being said, we have a lot of amenities that larger cities have, including Symphony, a Smithsonian Affiliate Art Museum, a Frank Lloyd Wright House Museum. We have big city amenities here. I think we've tried to sort of change that perception, while at the same time, and I think this is an important piece, we've tried to not turn our backs on the whole Americana Midwest part of what Springfield is, too. And those are great things, like you're talking about the Barnstorming Carnival, the Clark County Fair, the Summer Arts Festival, all these things that are going on kind of simultaneously right now. They are, you know, in my mind, they're almost like a slice of Americana. That's what people love about the Midwest. You know, they love that mix of kind of the sophisticated, you know, arts and culture along with what are your more traditional family activities. You know, as you see us kind of developing our messaging and our branding as we move forward, I think you're going to see us try to really fill that niche. That's exactly where we want to be to kind of differentiate ourselves maybe from the three big C's of Ohio.
One last question for you. With the STEM school and that educational hub coming to the south side of Springfield, do you feel good about that area's growth? I know they've had a downturn for a while, but it seems like there is an effort to address those issues.
I couldn't be more excited about that. Mike McDormand, our chamber president, and local legislators, and many, many other community leaders have worked incredibly diligently to try to get this thing to happen. And I think the reuse of South High School, for those in your audience who have never seen South, I mean, it is a gorgeous historic building complete with a Notre Dame-style dome. When the two high schools, when North and South consolidated a few years back, to become Springfield High School, you know, we vacated South High School and have been looking for a reuse. And that site is not only a phenomenal site, but it really serves as an anchor for the south end of Springfield. And I think it is such a key thing to revitalize that building. And I think the STEM school almost could not be a more perfect use, because that's an incredibly exciting prospect. It's going to be kids from all over who want to get involved in this ag bioscience program. And I just think it's going to really energize that area of town, and it's going to really connect the south end to downtown. So we could not be more excited about that.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time, that very detailed breakdown about what's going on out there in Springfield and Clark County. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thanks for your time, Wayne.
WYSO's Wayne Baker speaking with Chris Schutte from the Greater Springfield Convention and Visitors Bureau. Listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Juliette Frumholt, sitting in for Jerry Kenny. This month, WYSO's business and economics reporter Lewis Wallace has been focusing on one of the Miami Valley's biggest resources. Lewis joins me here in the studio to talk about some of his reporting. Lewis, welcome.
Hi, Juliette.
You have been doing a lot of reporting on water in the month of July, and water is a really important resource to the Miami Valley. Give us an overview of kind of how our area uses water beyond just what we get out of the faucet.
So there are so many pieces to it that I think people don't necessarily see. One is that all of the water, most of the drinking water for people who live in the Miami Valley, comes from this vast underground aquifer, the Great Miami Buried Valley Aquifer. It's 1.5 trillion gallons of water that is really in a pretty shallow, it's not the kind of aquifer that's buried deep, deep underground underneath hard rock. It's just right under the ground and in sand and gravel. And that's pumped up in the city of Dayton in a couple of well fields and distributed to about 400,000 people. So not just the city of Dayton, but many of the surrounding suburbs in Montgomery County and some parts of Greene County. And then various other towns and municipalities have their own systems or people sink their own wells. But we're all drinking this aquifer water. It's also used by businesses, manufacturing, food processing. Those types of businesses actually use a whole lot of water, obviously brewing, you know, anything in the drink industry as well. But the car industry has historically been a huge user of water in the Dayton area. And the fact that there's such an abundant resource there in the rivers and in the aquifer is really what allowed manufacturing in the first place to develop in Dayton, you know, 150 years ago. That use has declined over recent years. There are less companies using water now and a lot less demand on the City of Dayton water system than there used to be. And so city officials are actually looking at how to bring back some of that demand because it's a resource that it, by many is seen as being underused at this time. And then, of course, there's recreation, the beautiful rivers, and the possibility for developing more opportunities for people to be out on the rivers, canoeing and kayaking and having fun.
Now, as you were reporting this water series, there's been a lot of talk in the city of Dayton proper about protections for water and drinking water, and residents have had an opportunity to speak out on that. Can you describe that situation a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. I started doing some reporting just about the city of Dayton's efforts to market its water resources. And then in the middle of that reporting that I had kind of not released to the public yet, there started being a whole new conversation about maybe changing some of the protections that have been in place for a long time within the city of Dayton. So in the 1980s, there were several really kind of severe problems with pollution in the aquifer, and one of those became really visible in the form of this fire that happened at the Sherwin-Williams paint plant right on top of the city's well field. Basically, there was a big fire that they couldn't put out because if they were to spray water on it, all of these chemicals would have gone straight into the drinking water supply. And so that brought people's attention to the fact that the city and the region wasn't necessarily doing a great job protecting this water source from contamination. And some of that contamination is really hard to clean up. You know, you can't really, or it takes a really long time to get your water back to drinkable if you get some of the wrong stuff in it. And so the city passed a series of protections in collaboration again with the surrounding areas at that time. Now they're looking at limiting some of the area that's protected because of that reduced water demand.
And that is kind of an ongoing conversation between residents and the city of Dayton and the city commission that we'll be, I'm assuming, updating our listeners on as the news develops.
We will. There have been two public meetings. In those public meetings, a lot of people raise concerns about changing the area that's protected. There are some other pieces of the proposal that have seen a lot of support, increasing some of the list of hazardous chemicals and practices that are not allowed on that protected area, and just some reorganization of kind of the logistics of getting the chemicals out of the area that the city is looking at. So it's not just this talk about what area is covered, but we will be keeping people updated on air as much as possible and hearing from as many different people as possible who have an interest in this resource.
And tomorrow morning on Morning Edition, you'll be bringing us the next in the water series. Give us just a snapshot of what listeners can expect.
That's going to be all about how and why water could be Dayton's blue gold and how we're trying to market it to not just the region, but the whole country for the future.
Lewis Wallace, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was speaking with WISO's business and economics reporter, Lewis Wallace. That story about how the Dayton region markets its water resources will be on the air tomorrow during Morning Edition here on WISO and available online at wiso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fifth week of middle summer. Since I started my record of the weather and natural history, I've kept all my daily notes together. For example, all the July 20ths from 1979 through 2014 are in one place. With that organization, I've been able to see how, in spite of the separate character of each 12-month cycle, the progress of the seasons remains nearly identical from one year to the next. That arrangement of observation also makes clear the replicable nature of the days themselves. Instead of their linear succession away from one another, in my daybook, the notes from one afternoon are often interchangeable with those of another afternoon. Another afternoon the same day, 24 or 36 or 288 months later. After my father died, I began to look at time in a different way. Dad was no longer physically aging, no longer becoming more remote. Instead, with his death, all the phases and periods of his life took on the same distance from me. His childhood seemed no more remote than his middle age or his dying. Taken off the track of linear time, his complete life became more accessible and understandable. For so long, I concentrated on growth and on leaving behind and the progress towards something, as if that process would culminate in happiness or success or peace. Time was a series of independent steps on top of and away from what I had done before. Instead of just living on the spinning earth content with the repeating seasons, I was riding a meteor into space, never passing the same place twice. With the lessons from my notes and from images of my father, I go back and see that the crises of the years have gone by like so many storms in the weather record, like just so many images of flowering and decay. In the end, I'm like the woods and the fields and the sky, the same in spite of all the cycles and the changes. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the sixth week of Middle Summer. In the meantime, try stepping off the track of linear time.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. The Book Nook is coming up next, but first, we leave you with a tune from Mad River Railroad. This local bluegrass quartet will be performing at many fairs and festivals during the month of August, including the Miami and Dart County fairs. Here's one from a recent live set they did here on WISO on Kaleidoscope.
I was trailed by 20 hounds. Didn't get to sleep last night as the daylight rolled around. Said I'd run and better take my time. Friend of the devil is a friend of mine. If I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. $20 back and he vanished in the air. Said I'd run and better take my time. Friend of the devil is a friend of mine. If I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Thank you.
This week on Radiolab, the big mystery. How it is that just a bunch of these
little wisps of jelly in your head, called neurons,
flashing on and off in your brain, create
thoughts, ambitions, passions,
you,
even what you think of as your own intimate self.
And how, in a flash, that could all change.
In an instant, we can be completely transformed.
I'm Jad Abumrad. Join me for Radiolab.
Tonight at 6 on WISO.
American Roots celebrates the Newport Festivals. Trumpeter Clark Terry describes Duke Ellington's 1956 Newport Jazz Festival triumph. Joan Baez recalls the Newport Folk Festival, and producer George Ween brings memories of both events, plus performances from Ray Charles and the plugged-in Bob Dylan. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
This afternoon at 2 on 91.3 WYSO.